All right, the moment you've been waiting for, the Central Committee meeting. Does everybody have a copy of the Treasurer's Report for the agenda and also a list of the potential delegates to the National Convention? Dr. Glaser, would you read off, please, the list of Central Committee members that we have here?
Dean Ahmad, Moore Berto, William Calpino, Richard Davis, Lorenzo, and Susan Dostoniago, myself, Mark Grant, Bob Johnson, Ron Keane, Ranger, Doug McNeil, George Reynolds, George Sims, Scott Spencer, Marvin Hora, Tom Mathers, and Nikki Paratouri, James McLaughlin, Roy Brazier, Eric Lick, Catherine Class Friend, Christopher Gosher, and Dan Reed.
Is there anybody whose name was not mentioned who thinks they should or wants to be a Central Committee member?
No.
Come on, do you have a question?
Yeah, Tom Mathers is left.
Okay, and so did Ms. Classfriend.
In here.
Tom Mathers is left, and so did Ms. Classfriend, and also George Peacock. I don't know if he was on the list.
Okay, so who left? Tom Mathers?
Tom Mathers. Catherine Classfriend. And George Peacock. I don't know if he's really there. So I'm putting him on the list.
But so that gives us 22 Central Committee members in attendance, no proxies, and we have 35 Central Committee members.
Okay, very good. Thank you. The minutes were distributed last night. I sent out an email link.
I also put copies on each paper.
And they were also have been on the website since the picnic. Are there any corrections or adjustments to the minutes from the last meeting, which was the picnic, the date sent past us from the People's County last August? Minutes are so good. The Treasurer's Report, Mr. Linder.
Yes, everybody can flip over the other side of the agenda. There it is. Sorry, I'll stand back here. Hopefully everybody can hear me. This is all the information from our picnic that we stated earlier. First, says the income, and many may see, compared to the previous time, clicking funds, which is credit card prices where people have been contributing, that matches greatly to that, so the number of checks were deducted very diminished greatly, so it's not cash very well. The only thing is we do get charged the fee, or now it's clicking pledge change, and only gives me a check once a month. Simply, we went to a merchant system where money is deposited 3 days later into our general account. So, those are income contributed to our administrative account. We had $55 that came from political ads and went to the federal account. The one gave us any other money for the federal account. The rest is the list for our expenses from the we have to pay for this convention was. The list of all expenses in the balance of Bank of America, balance of our general account, the state regulator. We have a federal account. We are putting money into it. Over the previous executive decided to fund our radio campaign that early, get it started as soon as we can. Not wait until like the last two months or so, or even when we started, I think the last time the governor's right around July 4th. So we're looking to put that up to $1,000 and no money spent on the administrative account. And click and pledge, which is now like the past 3 days on Friday, that has been deposited. That we can tell. We had a few more that got processed late last night and this morning. But the victim, our click pledge, is no longer a small method check. So simply, PCH $1,000 conversion charge. Questions on the ground?
At the first, very good. Treasurer's report, so moved. What we want to do is soon after the primaries, which are the first Tuesday in April, we want to take $2,000 and put that into radio ads in WBAL and WTOP. We saw last year running ads early for Susan Bastianaga's campaign. We immediately generated attention that we hadn't received in years from the media, and we were to a certain extent able to force the Rhino government. Governor Bob Ehrlich on the gun issue, and also basically lifted Susan's rhetoric on the limiting the sales tax. He basically stole that for his own campaign. So we certainly saw the power of that, and we'd like to take the remainder funds that come in after that, just roll it into more ads, keeping at least $1,000 on hand in the state treasury. But we do want to use the majority of that money for running ads that come in. Currently, membership is at 88. It was actually over 100 a couple of weeks ago, and it's probably well over 90. Several of you have joined or renewed your membership. Thank you for your support. The registration is, as of the end of January, is at 9,795. The February report will be coming out in about a week or two, and it should be at 10,000 or real close. I don't know if we've ever had over 10,000 registered members in the party. Dina Mott? What is significant, I think, about having 10,000 registered members is the state, if we don't get 1% in the top of the ticket race, requires us to get these 10,000 signatures. If we have 10,000 registered voters, clearly have the support of 10,000 people. Why should we have to go out and collect these signatures? Furthermore, the Board of Elections doesn't want to do this. They have to hire a bunch of temporaries to do that. It costs six figures for them just to process these signatures. So I think it gives us a real foot in the door to be able to start getting some permanent ballot access in this state. Obviously, we're waiting to see what happens with our current ballot access situation. I did contact James Raskin, state senator from Montgomery County, who has been good, along with Andy Harris, regarding ballot access. And also, Jared DeMarinis of the Board of Elections also wants to work with us on this issue. I haven't heard back from them. I guess I didn't want to make an issue of it. I guess they're waiting to see what happens with the current lawsuit. We have spots for nine candidates this year, one U.S. Senate candidate and eight U.S. House candidates. To my knowledge, there are no state elections, no local county elections, and I don't believe there are any municipal elections in Maryland. My goal, again, is to run as full slate of candidates as we tried in the past or come real close. Of course, all of that hinges on the ballot access lawsuit. Having said that, and as frustrating as it can be, we are surrounded by states that have a lot worse ballot access than ours. For example, in Virginia, to run a statewide candidate, it takes 10,000 signatures. If you're running for governor or the U.S. Senate, if you're running for the U.S. House, it's 1,000 signatures. And they have to keep doing this until they can get someone running statewide that's 10%. In Pennsylvania, it's twice as bad because you're looking at 20,000 for statewide office and probably 3,000 to 4,000 just to run for the U.S. House. West Virginia has a very high filing rate. It costs $1,740 as a filing fee, even if you do have ballot access, just to run for governor or any of the congressional seats. Whereas here in Maryland, the highest fee is $290. So, you know, we have it better than a lot of states. It would be nice if we were like Delaware, which is much better, but, you know, as I said, it could be worse. I want to thank Mark for all the work he's done on ballot access. Moved Mark up because Mark has to leave soon. I think his wife is probably ready to kill me now, as much as Mark is put in time into the party, so I don't want to cause any more issues. There have been many of you have been in the party and the movement longer than I have, and I know people are like, you know, there have been times, why am I wasting my time? Am I out of my mind? There have been two concrete times I have really thought about packing it in. 3 years ago, I had one of my college roommates died in a car accident. I've been very fortunate. I just turned 49. He was the first and only person I've ever had close to me who has died before his time. So I'm very fortunate. I don't know why that mattered, but for whatever reason, just the energy went out. I didn't do anything political for a month. I just didn't care. The second time was the day after the November 2010 elections. And I spoke with many of you in this room that day. Muir, Lorenzo, Bill Redpath, Robert Glazer. I was very despondent. Only one of the seven races were we able to show any improvement in our numbers. The Castagnaga busted their butt in Susan's run for governor, running all over the state, and we weren't even the marshal 1%. So I was rather depressed. I think some of you had me, frankly, on suicide watch that day. I am grateful. Dean Amon called me up later in the day and cheered me up a little bit, and I appreciate that. But it was frustrating, and I'm sure many of us in this room have had those moments, you know, is it really worth my time? Less than a year and a half later, 16 months later, I must say, I don't know if I've ever been as optimistic towards the potential freedom as I've ever been. The success of the Ron Paul movement has really fired me up. I was at CPAC 2 years ago in D.C., and just the youth and the passion and energy there, it was just amazing. And you could see the panic in the conventional Republicans' eyes because they didn't have any of this passion whatsoever. There's a 10 to 20% voting block out there that is Ron Paul, that is libertarian, and we need to harness it. He puts a face on the movement we've never had before. I just switched Dennis about 6 months ago, and the young lady was asking me what I do for a living. Times are politically volatile, so I don't talk about my job very much. I work for a small political party. Oh, who's that? Well, the Libertarian Party. Who are they? Do you like Ron Paul? I love Ron Paul. You love us. I didn't have to talk about the war on drugs or passes or anything like that. Just those two words, Ron Paul, and I get that reception all the time. At worst, I get, well, I like Ron on most of the time. I've never met anyone who said, I hate Ron Paul. I don't like him at all. The man has a very positive connotation, and we need to harness this, the youth and the energy of this movement. Would it be nice to win elections? Absolutely. I would love to do it. I also maintain we do not necessarily have to win elections. As Bill has said before, the deck is stacked very much against us, and this is intentional. Okay, California, the top two. Not only that, the filing period is also ended in California, February 23rd, and they have to spend over $1,700 just to get on the ballot. At the convention last week in Richmond, a gentleman whom I respect was saying, why do we run candidates for state or national office and spend all that money instead of doing it locally? I bit my tongue. It wasn't my place to speak up. But my response was like, well, if our results are so embarrassing, why does the state keep fighting us all the time and doing what they can to keep us off the ballot, even with that embarrassing 1 or 2 or 3% vote? So the fact that they are fighting us tooth and nail tells me that we are getting under their skin and getting something done. I truly believe that if we could get 10% regularly or more in a federal election, and it's not because you have H. Ross Perot with a bottomless wallet, and it's not because you have a celebrity candidate like Drew Carey or Clint Eastwood, but someone who truly is libertarian, we can control the outcomes because the Democrats and the Republicans will have to adjust their platforms to deal with us. Perfect example, I've said this before, is gun control. Gun control no longer plays with the Democrats except in the big city. We had Frank Prattville running against Andy Harris 2 years ago, touting his A rating with the NRA, the Democrats. If I'm not mistaken, Mark Warner, didn't he have a better NRA rating than Jim Gilmore when he ran for governor?
I don't think so.
There was a Democrat, I recall a Democrat running for a statewide seat in Virginia who was bragging that he had a better NRA rating than the Republican did a few years back.
I don't know.
But nonetheless, it is clear that that gun control no longer plays except in the big cities with their agenda. You look at the states fighting back after Kelo versus New London, you know, 26 states, right after that Supreme Court decision came out and said, you cannot take land for eminent domain except for specific public usage, no more for big business usage. Virginia, the state legislature just basically nullified the NDAA this week that said that cops are not allowed, Virginia law enforcement may not use the law to imprison Americans without Fourth Amendment.
I'm not sure what they did on that.
I'm pretty sure it was along those lines. So people are fighting back. This is a good thing. And again, if we can win elections, great. But nonetheless, if we could get 5% in a presidential election, you know, ask Ralph Nader if he made a difference in the 2000 election. He'd be 2%. So I am very hopeful for freedom in the future. Our party is perfectly positioned to be that outlet. There's going to be a point in time. It may not be 2012. It may not be 2016. I definitely think it will be before 2020 that the people are going to be looking for something different than the D's and the R's. We are perfectly positioned for both sides of the political aisle. We need to get organized and get ready and take advantage of it. Anybody have any questions? First of all, let me, if I may, introduce the, dare I say, the greatest regional representative to the Libertarian National Committee ever, Dr. Jim Lahr. Dr. Lahr, could you come up if anyone has any questions? I have had no less than two chairs from other states who live in other regions who have spoken with me who wish Dr. Lahr was their regional rep.
Are they offering anything in trade?
No.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here. I had, of course, the pleasure of addressing you last year, and for some reason you actually seem to like what I said, so I'm, you know, sort of like, we'll do libertarianism for food. If you know, if you show me you like me, I'll keep coming back. So if there are any questions that I can answer, of course, also the national treasurer, Bill Redpath, is here, and so if we want a tag team, we can do that. Any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Later in the business meeting, this is going to come up again, but I would like to ask your input on it. This happens every time there's a national convention. It's happening again that apparently there's been an attempt to impose a floor treaty on delegates. I will not, because I'll get into it later, give all the reasons why this is not only a bad idea, but not a permissible idea under the rules. I would like your feedback on your perspective as a national committee member on this.
Well, my position, I actually, just before I drove up here, I was preparing an email that will go to my colleagues on the LNC. I actually have this unfortunate habit these days because I'm sufficiently busy. I now start sending what I call the great big omnibus messages, which are these remarkably long and incredibly, even more boring than usual messages that I send. And I basically try to deal with a lot of things, so they tend to be fairly long. My position now, as it was in 2010, as it had been previously, is that our bylaws don't enable the LNC or derivative committees to impose a floor fee or reservation fee. I don't think that our bylaws prohibit it, but I think the appropriate interpretation is that it's not allowed. And I tend to be one of those people, both with respect to the federal constitution and our own bylaws, who say that if it's not explicitly authorized or if it's not a clear deduction from something that is, then we shouldn't do it. Or at the very least, the bias should be against doing it, and those who are making the argument have a very strong burden of proof. I don't support it. I think it should be made, any sort of floor fee should be made voluntary. Now, I'm not sure how many people will agree with that on the LNC. Ultimately, the Judicial Committee may take this up, or it will be decided on the, perhaps on the floor of the convention. But I don't agree with it. Not because I necessarily think a floor fee of some sort is a bad idea, but it's just not, as far as I'm concerned, the bylaws don't allow it. At least the best interpretation that I have is the bylaws don't allow it. So that's the way I go with it. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Further, there was a question back here. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask you how many casinos
Jeffrey. For those of you who don't know, I hang my shingle principally in something called systems and information engineering. I'm really a mathematician by training. I also have an appointment in the Department of Applied Math and the Department of Statistics at the University of Virginia. I teach probability, the work for which I actually have a reputation in science is an entourage of probability theory, artificial intelligence, and operations research. Whenever I go into a casino, I just can't go over to these machines and play, pull them. I can't get involved in playing blackjack or other games of chance because I know what the odds are, and I'm a mathematician and I can count. Now, let me share something with you. Some of you may already know this. You actually can come up with strategies that will allow you to beat the house on an expected value basis. The problem is, of course, unless you've got what is referred to as an infinite amount of money, the chances are you can't sustain the losses, basically, that you'll have so that you can actually make that expected value return. One of these days, if I get an infinite amount of money, I'll be happy to go to Las Vegas and gamble. There are people in this room, by the way, who have been known to gamble on these matters, who have been known to play games of chance. Nothing wrong with that. I just can't force myself to gamble. Now, if they want to give me house money to play with, different story, but usually in Las Vegas they don't do that. Further questions or comments? Let me just, one point, my distinguished colleague, Mr. Johnson, let me share with you something that I think will bring a smile to your face. I had the pleasure a couple of weeks ago of speaking at the 5th International Conference of the Students for Liberty Organization. I've been at all of them. I was at the first one at Columbia University in February of 2008. And to see the explosion of interest among bright, talented young people is really impressive. I've been involved in this for a long time in terms of outreach to young people. And I've seen a lot of really talented young people. The current crop, the people we're bringing in now, are really extremely impressive. Not only are they very bright, not only are they very talented, not only are they very attractive personally, I mean, they're good-looking young men and young women, but they're nice people. And I happen to believe that the sort of revolutions we fight, an awful lot of it is being nice to people, showing them that libertarians are good folks. And we now have lots and lots and lots of young ambassadors. We're going to be able to go out. They'll be able to handle the ideas. They'll be able to encounter the tough arguments and handle them. But they're just nice people. They're the sort of people you'd like to have around. They're wonderful exemplars of the sort of people you'd like to have as libertarians. Now, more and more people start saying, oh, those libertarians, they're the nice people. They're the ones who actually treat us with courtesy and respect, even when they disagree with us. And in the sort of revolution we're fighting, which in many cases proceed inch by painful inch, in many cases the battle is not so much getting people to come over and agree with you and join with you, but getting them to the point where they don't feel they have to fight against you. When they start thinking, you know, those libertarians, you know, I disagree with them on a lot of things, but doggone it, they're pretty decent people. They're not going to steal my wallet. They're not going to send my kid to die in some damn meat grinder. They're basically pretty decent people, and the world's not going to go to hell if they're put in positions of responsibility. Look how far we've moved the ball down the field. I think you would have been absolutely delighted to see these incredibly bright, talented young people. By the way, the Libertarian Party was represented there. We had a table there. We had an ad in their program. I gave a workshop on campus organizing. I'm a member of the Board of Advisors for Students for Liberty. I shall also point out, not only are we seeing the rise of the Liberty Movement now in this country, but what we're seeing overseas is also very impressive. We now have libertarian student groups starting, I understand, in Malaysia and Indonesia. It's a very exciting time, as Bob has said. And so, again, if I can answer any questions or so, I'm going to be sticking around here, even though Duke and Carolina are playing at 7 o'clock tonight. Right. I'll be sticking around. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. If you want to ask them now, fine. If you want to come to me personally, privately, that's fine, too. But as always, thank you all for being here. Every one of you could be doing something else, but you took your valuable time and trouble to be here, be part of something very important. Again, thank you for your time.
I had sent this out before in one of my monthly messages. I urge you to listen to Dr. Lark's speech when he spoke to us last year. It's on MP3, linked on the State Party website. I urge you to download it and listen to it. It's great. I listen to it probably every 3 months, and I learn something new every time I listen to it. Captain Laser, do we have any unfinished business from the last Central Committee meeting? All right, then we shall go into this. Delegates to the National Convention. We are allotted 20 spaces and 50 alternates. If you are not one of the 20, but you are one of the alternates, Dr. Ahmad.
I apologize if I don't recall the agenda for you, but at this time, I would like to place on the agenda, whatever place you would recommend, a resolution regarding the four case proposal. I will do it now.
Is there any objection to undertaking the resolution? Go ahead. Floor is yours.
Opposition is right.
Correct.
Well,
unless there's any major objection, is there any to do this now?
Is there another new? I don't see anything.
Oh, that's
all right. In that case, I will wait until
then. Okay, that's fine. Delegates in the national convention, we have space for 20 delegates. We also have space for 50 alternates. Even if you're an alternate, you still should be able to proceed with another delegation. Mr. Redpath, what is the procedure? I've never been to a national convention. What is the procedure for getting alternates seated with another delegation?
Dr. Mark, what is the procedure? I believe that it just has to be, it has to be approved by the committee. Well, they have to be vetted by the credentialing committee, and then it basically, after the initial report, then basically the credentialing committee basically says these people would like to join these delegations, and then it's put to a vote of the convention.
Is it possible, could I call another state and say, hey, I have half a dozen people, more than enough, can they be seated, as long as it's okay with your state bylaws?
Oh, have them approved. Sure. I mean, you can shop around, you get a good price in some cases.
No,
it has just about always, and as far as I can recall, always been the case, that other states will seat people from other states. If a state delegation has some FTC people who want to join, it's okay with that delegation, and it's approved by the body as a whole, that is the convention delegates, then you're seated. So I will say that in practice, there were a lot of people who were concerned last week in Virginia about, if I go as an alternate, will I get seated? I would say 98% chance the answer is yes, because there are delegates. I mean, for instance, I would be shocked if everybody who's a full delegate from Virginia actually goes out there to the convention, I'll think dead away. And so I think that if you go as an alternate, I can't guarantee it, but a very high chance you will ultimately be seated as a delegate.
As someone who has been a member of the Credentials Committee, this is my recollection of how it works, and Jim or Bill can correct me if anything has changed formally. But each state has its own rules on how to fill or replace the substitute for the state delegation. As long as the Credentials Committee has not given its final report, the state in question goes to the Credentials Committee and says, according to our rules, we want so-and-so to be in our delegation. The Credentials Committee determines that is in fact the case, that they are consistent with the rules, national health, certify them, and that will be the end of it. It is after the Credentials Committee has given its report that the Credentials Committee then has to go to the floor and say such and such a state now wants to add, somebody to the delegate.
Dean, I think you're right. But that credentials report is given near the beginning of the convention.
That's correct.
So I think up to that point, I believe you are correct. Subsequent to that, near the beginning of the convention, subsequent to the first credentials report, then it has to pass the delegation.
Correct.
It passes the delegation almost always.
The leader requires unanimous consent.
What?
It requires unanimous consent. It almost always gets it.
I don't think it's unanimous. To get you seated with another delegation, so you don't have to go out to Vegas wondering if I'm going to be able to serve as a delegate or not. So I will do that. I have passed out a list of people who have contacted me about wanting to serve as a delegate and their first ballot presidential choice. Is there someone in here who is not on the list who wants to be? Mr. Palmer.
Sorry, I didn't know that.
Who'd you say?
Garrett Palmer. Anybody else?
I'll ask one more. So we're talking just about the 16 people here who are not listed as office, two officers, right? 16 plus.
Correct.
So Derek will be 17 out of 20?
Correct.
Okay, so we still need three more forward.
We could put the two alternates on, Darlene and Steve, who weren't sure they were going to Vegas or not.
Right now you have 17 names you want to be, plus you have three spots to fill.
Well, we can do 19. We can elect, as long as nobody else wants to be listed as a delegate, we can elect this as a slate with a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of electing this list as our national delegates as a slate, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Dr. Glazer, may I suggest that for the list of alternates, we put the remaining special committee members on the list of alternates?
Right, that is the general rule. What we always do is we take the remaining special committee members and put them just automatically as alternates.
We have room for 50 alternates.
But if there's anybody here who wants to be an alternate who is not a special committee member, is not a delegate, they've got to keep on that. That includes MDLP members who are not special committee members.
Okay, is there any objection to listing the central remaining central committee members as alternates to the national convention? Okay, very good. All right. Candidate nomination of Mr. Linder, Mr. Dr. Ward.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just as a reminder, we want to make sure that the list of delegates gets to the Credential Committee at least 1 month in advance.
Yes, thank you. Okay, candidate nominations for this November's office. There are seats up for the one U.S. Senate seat and eight U.S. House seats. And we shall begin. Mike Calfino, first U.S. House seat. Please come on up.
Mr. Warren.
That is currently being held by Andy Harris.
Okay. A lot of you know me. My name again is Michael Calfino. And I've been a libertarian for as long as I've been a resident of the People's Republic of Maryland, for about 8 years. A few years ago, I received your nomination to run for Wacomico County Council, which I did. Spent several months knocking on doors and waving my sign by the road and making phone calls and handing out literature, actions I repeated last year in support of Mr. Botus' campaign for Calgary City Council. And I was also told that campaign achieved the first and that I was the first libertarian in Maryland to be endorsed by a major newspaper, in this case the Calgary Daily Times. All told, I received 30% of the vote, and at that point in time I did such a great job losing that race that Mr. Johnson approached me and asked me if I would seek the nomination for the first district and giving Dr. Davis a break from his several runs for that office. So since that time, for the last year and a half, I've been working and preparing for that race and that nomination. I've been involved in the Tea Party movement since 2009, first with Americans for Prosperity and currently with the Maryland Society of Patriots. I've continued to write to the paper, regular editorials, making contacts amongst my Tea Party friends and members in the area as far as support for the campaign, including financial support. And in addition to my somewhat irregular blog, which some of you received, I also wrote the following, Leave Me Alone, A Patriot's Plan for Restoring Pride and Prosperity to America. And in there I detail three areas that I think are important in restoring our country to its founding principles. Number one being restoring our moral fiber. That being achieved through a wholehearted and uncompromising embrace of capitalism. Capitalism being more than just economics, but as Ayn Rand said, the only moral way of organizing society. In that system, government only has one role, and that is the defense of individual rights. And any kind of steps outside that role, it becomes tyrannical, and it dehumanizes and it steals from the people that it is supposed to be serving. Only when we restore individual freedom and voluntary associations will we see our families, our community organizations, our religious organizations be restored as the pillars of society that they're supposed to be, and see morality and virtue encouraged amongst individuals. Second area is the restoration of our economic health. And the greatest impediment to that is central banking, in our case, the Federal Reserve. It's the Federal Reserve's ability to legally counterfeit money that has enabled our government to grow beyond all bounds, reasonably constrained through taxation and borrowing. It's the Fed's intervention in the market that causes the bubbles and leads to the wild swings in the business cycle. It's the Fed's caused inflation that steals our money and compels us to put our money into the stock market and into the banks, the very cartel that created the Fed in the first place. So only by returning the sound money and transparent free market banking are we going to restore the long-term economic health of our country. The third area is the one that's gotten me into a little bit of trouble with my libertarian friends. And that is my belief that Islam, as it's currently practiced and propagated by its foremost opponents in Saudi Arabia and Iran, constitutes the greatest external threat to our liberty today. This is not an attack on religion. This is an attack on a statist political ideology, because Islam assumes the use of force to achieve its objectives on the society and on individuals. In the 18th century and before, we had the totalitarianism of kings and of absolute monarchs. In the 20th century, we had communism and fascism that sought to destroy the freedom of man. It's my personal belief that in the 21st century, we are going to see that role taken by Islam. Now, that position has apparently put me at odds with the current direction, the recent direction, of the Maryland Libertarian Party. Mr. Johnson was kind enough to call me 2 weeks ago and let me know that because he and I assume the executive committee have decided to wholeheartedly embrace the Ron Paul movement, as we kind of heard a little bit tonight, that my disagreements with Mr. Paul on the minimization of militant Islam and Iran in particular may now put in jeopardy that nomination that I was previously encouraged to accept and prepare for. Now, this is not the time or place for debate on that matter. I'm not here to defend the intricacies of my position. But I will say a few things, however, in my defense. First of all, I agree with Mr. Paul on the vast majority of things. As far as economics and personal liberty, Fed, near 100%. Foreign policy, majority. I oppose the Patriot Act. I don't think we should have military bases all over the world. I do believe that we have caused conflict and ill will among many nations by trying to pick winners and losers, which is just as disastrous in foreign policy as it is in economic policy. However, it is my love of liberty and of free speech and of conscience and of action and of religion that compels me to resist any ideology that seeks to enslave the hearts and minds of men, whether that ideology comes from communists in the Kremlin or in Washington, D.C., socialists in Brussels, fascists in Venezuela, or the mullahs in Iran or Saudi Arabia. Ron Paul's a good guy, and he has been a consistent and long-term defender of liberty and economic freedom and a critic of the government for a long time, and he deserves our respect and adoration for that. However, Ron Paul's not God, and he's not infallible. And it is my personal belief that in areas regarding militant Islam, and Iran in particular, that he's wrong. I can hope that he's right. I can hope that the mullahs in Iran are a rational regime, that like the old Soviet Union, they're not going to use their nuclear weapons that they seek against their neighbors or against us. However, if he's wrong, and Ahmadinejad and the mullahs are willing to sacrifice their nation in a delusional attempt to destroy the little and the big Satan, to bring about Armageddon and the revelation of their Messiah, millions of people are going to die. Millions of our fellow citizens may die. And it would be, people threaten us, we should take that seriously. If they have the means of following through with that threat, it would be my job, if elected, as a congressman who has taken an oath of office to defend the Constitution against enemies, both foreign and domestic, to do what is necessary to minimize that threat. Personally, I believe it would be wrong to deny me a nomination because I have one disagreement with one policy, with one man, who's not even actually a member of the Libertarian Party. Because if we're the party of free speech, and we believe in that conjecture and criticism are the foundations of a free society, then they lead to better solutions for mankind. If we can't tolerate any dissent, not over principle, but over policy, and we hold up one man as the infallible arbiter and determiner of what is correct and acceptable, then I think we're denying the very principles and ideals of which we purport to uphold. Because we are the party of principles. We are the party of the Constitution, and we are the tireless defenders of natural rights. I embrace those principles with every breath that I take. And I believe that this government, the government that is constituted to protect and defend those rights, has now become its greatest opponent. Under the Obama administration, we are seeing the end results of 100 years of slow creep away from our founding principles and into statism. We have elected a radical Marxist, and he and his communist cohorts have done things with that power that most Americans could not have even conceived of 3 years ago. And it scares a lot of them to death. This government has put the pedal to the metal in its war on human rights and dignity, which is always to sacrifice at the altar of totalitarian control. This war on the family, and on success, and on religion, and on individuals, has put every single American on the front lines. Our conversation has changed, as Mrs. Obama wanted it to. And the message of liberty and freedom, and attacks not only on the evils and corruptions of the people that are in power, but on the very edifice of power that has been created by the abandonment of our founding ideals, will never find a more receptive audience, as they will this election. As the party's representative in the first district, I will take that message all over the Eastern Shore and some parts of the West, however they have gerrymandered me in there, and I will take that message all over there, and I will boldly confront the powers of the status quo, and I will try and convince our fellow citizens that only by returning to our founding principles are we going to see the restoration of the pride and prosperity in our country and its very survival. There you go. I'll take questions now. I stand up here for frozen tomatoes and everything else.
I would never throw a tomato at Mike.
Okay. Well, thank you.
But you know, Mike, my problem with your thesis has to do with the fact that by calling these creeps in Iran and Saudi Arabia Islamists, you're actually doing them a favor. That's like saying, like, Torquemada was a Christian. I really object to that, you know. You know, these guys are not real people, you know. In my opinion, what they say they are. They're doing what lots of people have done throughout history. They take political power and they use a religious excuse to solidify their power. And I think that this is, if you're going to present this at all, this has to be done. I mean, instead of saying that it's Islam, well, that just isn't really true.
Okay.
I would also, you know, what Lorenzo was saying, I wouldn't tie it with a particular religion. And also, I think there's more nuances to it. I'm not saying that I know that much about it, but we've done some crazy stuff, you know, like trying to do a war of attrition in Iraq versus Iran. I believe his name was Khan. He was with the Pakistanis. He just gave all the information to people how to build a bomb, and because they're our allies, I think he got a slap on the wrist. So I don't know. I think there's a lot more politics than just saying that Iran is this terrible, terrible thing. There's a lot of history.
Keep in mind, they are about to put together, they'll put to death, or may have already, an individual for possibly, as it thinks.
Sure. No. There's a lot of history. And again, I wouldn't tie it, just, you call them crazy people or something, but I wouldn't tie it with a religion, per se. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, keep in mind, my personal argument is the fact that it's any time a religion, any group, whether they call themselves a religion or not, the Church of the Inquisition, same thing. The idolaters of antiquity, same thing. If they use force to enforce religious dogma, they have crossed the line. Now, whether that's, you know, that may be politically incorrect, because currently those are the guys that are doing it. And they call, most of them are named Muhammad, and they embrace the Prophet, and they adhere to that religion. I can't change that. Those are the guys that are doing it. You know, and I think by constantly tiptoeing around that and trying to be politically incorrect or correct and embracing this multicultural idea that everything's honky-dory and it's just a few nuts out there, it minimizes that threat. Because, you know, you can say, well, you know, all religions are equal and everything, but, you know, just a few weeks ago, there was a trial in Pennsylvania. And we're talking about American soil here. There was a parade down the street, and there were two atheists that were out there. One of them was dressed like a zombie Pope, and the other one was dressed like zombie Muhammad. And lo and behold, who comes out? A Muslim comes out and punches the guy out. That's representing my honor. There's no understanding of free speech. You know, the honor killings, the whole thing that's going on, even in our own country, it needs to be addressed. Okay. I think we'll go to the back first, and then we'll come to you, because I know you've had your hand up the whole time.
In the name of God, and most gracious, I agree with the previous speakers, and I am concerned that a focus on this issue, a presentation on this issue, would have actually misrepresented the Libertarian Party. But addressing your comments in your presentation, it's not a question of your disagreeing with one man on one issue. The Libertarian Party has a platform of a very strong non-interventionist foreign policy. I happen to be a critic of the regimes in Iran and Saudi Arabia. But that ain't the business of the U.S. government. That is the business of the people of Iran and Saudi Arabia. And my concern is that just as the paleoconservative movement was hijacked by the Red Baiters, that we are in danger of having our movement, at the very moment when it is becoming recognized, appreciated, and perhaps, God willing, successful, to be hijacked by the Islamophobes and the Muslim leaders. So that even though what was said before is totally correct, I'm concerned about the Libertarian Party's platform. We have to present our position consistently. And our position is that the job of the United States government, the federal government, is to defend the U.S., to provide a court of last resort, and to guarantee the Republican form of government nationally. And any attempt to give it beyond that and to say, well, there are bad people in Iran and there are bad people in Saudi Arabia and we got to do something about it, or even in Syria, where there's obviously a very bad regime that's killing innocent people, or in Libya, where there was a crazy man, exactly, an anarchist, but he was a crazy anarchist, and our intervention has only made things worse. This is my concern, and I think we have to be careful, especially where we are in our growth, because our candidates, let's face it, not only are going to win the election, but they are going to explain to people what we're about. And fear-mongering is not what we're about. We're about trying to make sure that this country remains the freest country on the earth. And if we do that, it will also remain the strongest and the most prosperous. Also, I want to mention, you know, the United Republic of Iran has never, never initiated a war against anybody. They couldn't initiate one against us if they wanted to. We, the United States, with its interventionist foreign policy, fixed Saddam Hussein on Iran. And the disaster that came to only resulted in our going into Iraq and losing all those American lives and all that American treasure and bringing us to the brink of bankruptcy. We really have to be very firm and clear on this, and our candidates have to be candidates who will attempt this.
Okay.
Okay.
First of all, hold on a second here. I don't want to take up all the time because I know there's not here. But first, let me say that I agree with the non-interventionist policy. But the only way that that's going to happen is if there's nothing over there that we need to be concerned with national security. And the only way that happens is if we have energy independence and that oil doesn't mean anything anymore. If that doesn't mean anything anymore, I'd be happy. Just pull out, let it go. And if we had brought oil down to $30 or $15 a barrel, then Saudi Arabia wouldn't have the money to export Wahhabism all over the world and build mosques and do that. And overall, as you are the great example, that Muslims can make the transition to having Islam be only a matter of conscience and not a matter of force. And if we as America can foster that and export that rather than importing a violent version of Islam, then we're going to achieve something over the long term, that we can live in peace with all men. But if you've got a lot of people that don't want to live in peace with us, not necessarily because of what we're doing in the last 20 years, but because of 1,400 years of history, that those things have to be recognized, and we have to deal with things as they are now. Okay.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you.
And upon you, sir.
First of all, I agree with the three gentlemen ahead of me. I don't agree with what the Iran is going on. We took the our soldier, Saddam, we took him out of the way, and I think you would have been part of the group who encouraged invading Iraq. And now you know what's changing your mind.
You would be wrong.
That's also just people who in this country were intending avoiding Iraq. Iran is not even 10% of Islam. And it's just like, alhamdulillah, I'm American now, just like you and I travel now, and people in India or in Jordan would be calling you Charlie Manson or Jimmy Jones or be calling Jimmy Jones. To make the Islam dirty by making it just everything comes out of Iran as it is mandated by Islam, that's wrong. So it is not. It is just like it's just like calling you Jimmy Jones or Karl Manson. But in the meantime, you forgot that we, the one as Americans, who brought the disastrous things to Iran. Iran had a democracy in the 50s. They were a flourishing country. We made the CIA, we under agents, toppled the government, and we put our puppy there, Shah Iran. So, you know, it is our creation. Whatever is happening right now, even Iran, dominating the Middle East area, which is probably earlier came about Syria, something like we know Syria. Syria is getting the support from Iraq, which is our creation. Maliki is our puppy, and he goes and kisses the mullah's hand. Who put him there? We did. So instead of turning the anger to Iran, or say, why don't we talk about the people who put him there? One, two. I mean, it's just like, so what? Even if they have nuclear at the end of the day, Russia was a Cold War. They have all kinds of nuclear. They didn't attack us once they have. But nobody say that Israel have nuclear, because we are all afraid. It's the elephant in the room. Nobody talks about anything. Israel have nuclear, and it's going to have every country there. They're going to be rich to have nuclear too. Just like the Korea want to have their bodies. So diplomacy is more important, and I wish they did diplomacy before even once the Saddam was there. But I'm not a Republican, by the way. But to take a position like that, I admire your party, and I was putting the word out since 2 weeks I have attended one of the meetings for your party. And like Susan said, I was out collecting money for you. But if I see people like you, trust me, I won't. Because you put in me, you've given me a hat for Iran which I don't wear, and I don't deserve to wear it anymore.
Mr. Palfino, I have a question. Under a Palfino administration, what would be your specific methodology for defense?
For defense?
Yes.
I don't think that we need bases in most places that we have them. I think a strong, enlarged navy that can go wherever it's necessary at any point in time would be sufficient. And I think if we build up goodwill and economic relations that people can see benefits to that in interacting with us, that's going to go a whole lot farther than military intervention. Because that's just gotten us into a lot of trouble. And our history shows that. And I agree with that history. And I'm not, because Iran is the focus right now, I mean, I know that Iran and their brand of Islam is a minority. It's actually the Saudis and their export of Wahhabism that is probably a much larger threat. But, you know, that's neither here nor there at this point in time.
Can you talk to you what your position is? Would you be for preemptive? Attacks against various countries.
Well, that's a question that I've had ever since 2 years ago, and you and I have talked about this a lot in time. I mean, if I'm gonna hit Bob, at what point in time does he have the right to defend himself? When I say I'm gonna hit you, Bob. When I draw back and say I'm gonna hit you, Bob. When I actually hit him, does he have the right to defend himself once it's actually happened? See, that becomes the real question with Iran. If they get a nuclear weapon, and they say that we're going to destroy this, we're going to destroy this, and then we wait until they launch an EMP attack against the United States and put us back into the 1800s for quite a few months, if not years, or they blow up a city, or they export it to Hezbollah, which is already on our southern border, and they bring it across and blow something up. I mean, at what point in time, you know, I'm going to hit you, do you say that? I think that amidst all their rhetoric, keeping them from having the means to follow through with that would be an important foreign policy
means
objective.
What specific means? Such as a preemptive strike on any nuclear
facility? On any nuclear facility? I wouldn't have a problem with cooperating with the Israelis with that. And it's a one-time thing. You see, the problem is the way we fight wars with a nation building, trying to give Republican democracy to people that don't have it. It's not within their acceptance. It's not going to work. At least not in the near term.
It's not our job.
It's not our job, and it's not going to work. And it's been a failure, and it's shown to be a failure.
Would you put them out of Syria and Afghanistan and Libya?
I wouldn't put them in there in the first place. They don't belong there. The whole point is to, as I said earlier, isolate the whole region. Make it insignificant. Until they discovered oil, it was insignificant. You know, whoever heard, you know, from the time of Jefferson when he had to deal with them all the way until the 30s, the Middle East was insignificant. Nobody cared about it. You know, so, you know, the Europeans did their colonial thing, but there wasn't anything there that was really valuable. All of a sudden they had oil, they had all this money, and then they could export what they had been developing there since, you know, Wahab in the 1700s and his idea that everybody was using except for him and all that kind of thing, and they exported that and it gave them power. If we isolate them and take their power away and take the money away, then they become insignificant.
And I don't want to make any... I don't deny that those guys, pardon my language, suck over there, but giving the analogy of the fist, I think the fist of the U.S. federal government is 100 times bigger and 100 times closer to me than the Middle East fist.
No doubt. And keep in mind
that foreign policy... Using your logic, at what point do I have the right to do a preemptive strike against the federal government?
Well, now we get into Second Amendment issues and things like that. I mean, you know, that's...
I don't deny the potential of a threat. I just don't think it's anywhere near as big as the threat to our U.S. government, particularly with the police state that is being created.
I agree with you completely. Keep in mind that this is one small area that you presented me with 2 weeks ago and said, this little area, you know, I'm sure you agree with me that over the time of all the things that I've written, all the things that I've talked about, my commitment to individual liberty and economic freedom and Ayn Rand-style capitalism.
I love your passion.
You cannot question that.
I have no question. I love
and
your passion.
This is one small area
of
foreign
policy. But I don't think it's 5 or 10%. I think it's about 40% of the equation.
Okay. Are we going to get time for any other candidates? We just got to have a quick vote here.
But
yes or no, and bring it.
But this is important. Mr. Flagel.
All right. My question is, you're running in the First District, correct?
First District, yes.
Okay. Are you running on principle, or are you running, do you have principles regarding foreign policy, or are you basically running because you're running against someone like Andy Harris, who's in the military and feels really need to help this
to be elected? I don't know that much about Andy Harris. No, I'm running on the principles that I've outlined. That individual
principles, though. I mean, as an 8-year Air Force veteran, I look at it this way. Look, they might be a threat. They might be a threat, okay? But you're kind of like going back in this mindset that we just have muskets and cannons if Iran was really legitimately a threat to our national defense. You know? And let's get back to the principle of what libertarianism was all about. And that's why I don't think it's wrong to promote the ideas that really kind of laid out.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I just one very specific question. If Iran does not attack the United States or Israel, but acquires nuclear weapons, do you believe it is legitimate for us to use preemptive attack against them?
Well, the question is, if they acquire nuclear weapons, and it's all the rhetoric that says basically that they're going to use them, do we believe them? Personally, I do. I believe that they will. Now, I could be wrong. That's my personal opinion. I accept what people say.
They were wrong about weapons of mass destruction for the most part in Iraq, and the same cast of characters that are beating the drum or were beating the drum for war with Iraq are out there right now. You know, you've got Bolton Fox every day banging that drum for war with Iran. And if they attack us or if they attack an ally, you've got some legitimate point. But if they don't do that, I don't see how a libertarian can say that we can use force against them.
But keep in mind the stakes, though. We're not talking about, are they going to attack us by going across somebody's border like Saddam Hussein did with Kuwait? You know, that it's a whole different thing when you're talking about dropping or placing a nuclear weapon in a city. I mean, that raises the stakes so much higher.
But if Russia or China, they had nuclear weapons directed at our city, they all actually had a capacity.
And as Mr. Schlegel said, you know, it's not like we're fighting with muskets from the 18th century.
We have
half the world's munitions.
But that's the other question is, are they rational? Okay, maybe,
let's
you know, you've got North Korea. Let's compare them to North Korea. What does North Korea use their nuclear weapons for? They use them to blackmail the rest of us, so we send them food because they're a failed regime and can't provide for their own people. That's what they use them for. Now, Iran doesn't have that problem. So what are they seeking it for? We can only assume that the reason they seek the nuclear weapons is to fulfill their rhetoric. I take them at their word. That's all.
And I mean, I'll take them at their word by default also. Nonetheless, I still think we're able to defend ourselves easily no matter what they throw at us.
Because as Stalin said, we will bury it.
Sure. And every time they perceived weakness in us, they got closer. And you've got Iran now that's putting missile bases in Venezuela, cooperating with the Venezuelans to do that. That brings it a whole lot closer than way over there.
We'll have a question here. I think we have a lot of candidates, and I know this is very interesting. But, Mike, I think you've made your point. I mean,
I think so, too.
If I were to say that we should go on, am I cutting you off?
No. Like I said 10 minutes ago, I said I know we've got other candidates.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
To be successful, nomination must receive 60% of the vote.
Are there any anybody running for this?
Is anybody else running for the first U.S. House seat? No. Okay. All those in favor of Mr. Calpino's nomination, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Nay.
Okay. So the fifth U.S. House seat, Arvin Bora. This is the seat held by Steny Hoyer.
Mm-hmm. I would like to just take 2 or 3 minutes and address something that's been presented to me by many organizations within the libertarian movement and very closely associated movements. And the idea is, and this is very different from what Carlos was saying earlier, the idea is that we should run as almost exclusively an economic platform and de-emphasize or ignore the social aspects of our platform. And I want to briefly explain why I disagree with that. I believe that the second half of that sentence is that we should avoid talking about social issues so that we don't have to confront people on areas where they are either bigoted or uninformed. I think it's a way to say that let's not talk about marriage so that we don't have to confront people on their homophobia. Or let's not talk about immigration so that we don't have to confront people on their xenophobia. And with apologies to Mike, we should not talk about our foreign policy so we don't have to confront people on their Islamophobia. And I strongly and absolutely reject that. Because I believe that when you do that, you are essentially a hair's breadth away from doing what candidates like Rick Santorum, for example, has done so effectively, which is convince people that by engaging in something that's fairly simple, that they are exceptional. I think Rick Santorum has essentially spread the message that says, if you are fluent in English and you are a Christian, you are part of American exceptionalism. And I don't hold to that for a second. I think the word exceptionalism has been tossed around in politics in a way that does not hold with any dictionary or any reasonable definition of what the word exceptional means. When I think of American exceptionalism, I don't think of English fluency. I think of the people who started Intel. I think of Bill Gates. I think of people who, if we had better immigration policies, would have started their businesses here, the founder of IKEA. One of the failures, I believe, of our immigration policy is that we did not get him here before he founded IKEA. So when we approach it from a purely economic standpoint, I believe we end up taking like the heart and the meaning out of the ideas of liberty. I mean, when Socrates was put to death, the issue at stake was not that the government had to pay for some hemlock, although they did. And when Copernicus or Galileo were put under house arrest for telling the truth, I don't think the issue was that they had to pay, you know, one police officer to stand outside of their house. I think the issue is something far more fundamental. I believe that the heart of liberty is the social policy, the idea of free speech, the idea that we can do what we want as long as we're not hurting anybody else. Sometimes people say that morality has no place in politics. That is, I believe, absolutely wrong. The entire libertarian philosophy is a moral philosophy. It's a philosophy that says, I will not initiate force upon another person. I think that is an absolute essential idea for us. One of my friends showed me a list that had been circulating around Facebook and the internet, and it was a voting list of what people considered to be the most immoral actions. And at the top of that were prostitution and polygamy. And somewhere lower down was rape and murder. Now, what that tells me is that people in this country have confused personal taste with morality. Morality is a philosophy. It's not just like what you happen to like. It's something with a coherence and meaning behind it. When we substitute just personal taste, you know, if we find, you know, homosexual activity off-putting, if we substitute personal taste for actual legitimate moral philosophy, that is a type of ignorance that is no different than the type of ignorance that many people have had with regards to, for example, the Federal Reserve, that Ron Paul has been so effective in combating. The other issue is when we replace morality with personal taste, we end up making economic mistakes that are based on that personal taste. For example, when we talk about welfare, there's a lot of people who dislike welfare. I am certainly one of the people. I not because I think that we shouldn't help the poor. I just think that this particular system has not been very effective at doing it. I think that welfare is a skill that requires much more innovation and creativity than what has been done so far by the government. But when you look at welfare, which is about $30-some billion a year, but ignore other types of wealth that are significantly larger, it's like you're allowing that taste to get in the way of actual logic. I actually recently wrote a book called Lies, Damned Lies in College Admission. I put a couple free copies back there. And one of the things that it's important to know is that colleges get about twice as much welfare as individuals. And it's come to the point that if you're at a private college, due to these government subsidies that essentially reward colleges for charging more, if you're at a private college and you're sitting in a lecture, you are paying $100 an hour to sit in that lecture. Now, that's not what the professor's making. That means per student, the university is getting $100 an hour. If there's 200 kids in the class, the university is getting $20,000 an hour. That is not a free market price, and that's a reflection, I believe, of that taste we all like colleges masquerading as morality, as in we should therefore subsidize colleges. The other area where that is also reflected is in healthcare. We think that healthcare is good. I certainly think that healthcare is good. But the extension that because it's good, because we like it, we should therefore subsidize it, is as ridiculous as saying that it's moral to take money from one person and give it to this other person so that he can go to university and study moral philosophy. It's absolutely, completely backwards. So in a sense, what I think that and what I intend to do with my campaign is to combine both the social and the economic standpoint. I certainly welcome any questions on those areas. You'll find me as a candidate that I'm aggressive, that I really work to build a large base on our Facebook page. We have approximately 30,000 fans. Most of those are not people that were libertarian. Most of those are converts that were either formerly Democrats
or formerly Republicans that looked at our message and really responded to it. During the last campaign, which is a statewide campaign, I also did a certain amount of outreach through internet radio. I was on a TV show that is actually in the South Asian community, probably the most popular TV show in the county. Many people who didn't even know I was running actually saw me for the first time on that particular show. Any support that I get is something that I'm going to be using to build a long-term campaign. Corporations know that that elections are multi-election cycles, and that is exactly how I view them. So at this point, I welcome any questions about any of my views or anything else. Dean.
I just like to make a comment regarding your words, because you're obviously a person that's well spoken. I think you'll make a fine candidate. But I really think you'll present yourself more effectively if you don't talk about morality. All questions of morality are just a question of morality. I think there are issues of morality beyond the non-aggression principle. The important thing for us as libertarians is that when it comes to politics, the non-aggression principle is the only relevant moral question. Because some people think that prostitution or polygyny is immoral. I wouldn't, define them out of the ballpark. I would say that's when we're getting a moral question to discuss. It just has nothing to do with our political position, which is totally determined by the non-aggression.
And I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think that there's a difference between a considered moral opinion, if either based on sort of an academic type philosophy that after careful consideration has come up with saying that, prostitution is morally wrong. And I have no problem with that. In fact, I actually, although I disagree with Rick Santorum on almost everything, I do believe that he has considered the different viewpoints. What I dislike seeing is where there's issues that are passed off as issues of morality that are clearly issues of just like bad science. I mean, the idea that drunkenness is okay, but marijuana requires that people be locked up, to me is an incoherent position. I can see that somebody can morally be opposed to both, but the moral opposition to one and not the other to me is an uneducated standpoint.
Any other questions? Okay, 60% vote is required for the nomination. Mr. Winder?
Fifth,
Sandy
Hoyer.
Fifth.
Five.
Five,
Chad
on Maryland's Western Shore, St. Mary's County, Calvert, part of Charles, part of Puget County. All those in favor of Mr. Gore's nomination say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, very good. Remember to get your certificate of nomination. Dean Ahmad, would you be interested in being nominated for the U.S. Senate seat?
No, I would not.
Okay. Mark Granis had to leave early. He had expressed an interest in running for the 8th U.S. House. Yeah, the 8th U.S. House seat, which is Chris Van Hollen's district. I would like to, Mark ran in that seat 2 years ago, and I would like to see him run again, and he is interested. He just wasn't here to speak on his behalf. But I would
again?
Mark ran in Van Hollen to the 8th.
What seat again? I'm sorry.
The 8th. 8th Van Hollen. Montgomery County. Yeah. Is there any objection to my proposing Mark ran as the potential candidate? Okay. All those in favor of Mr. Brandis' nomination, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Very good. Does anybody else want to run or nominate somebody else to run at this time? We have until June 29th to get the declaration of intent. Yes. Mr. Sims.
The reason we need the situation with
the Senate,
can we get a
quick
explanation?
I can get a real quick explanation. Okay.
We weren't able to get $10,000 worth of pledges.
Okay, and that was one of his preconditions.
How much did we get?
It depends on what you count. If you count just the actual pledges, it was about $2,750. The state would contribute $2,000 for advertising, so that would make it $4,750.
We had to get $10,000.
Okay, again, we have...
Please come close.
We have 6 other U.S. House seats available and 1 U.S. Senate seat. We have until June 29th to file the Declaration of Intent.
and my intention is to get as many of those seats filled as soon as possible. So if anyone is interested or even chewing on it, please let me know. Okay. Election of officers to the executive board. There are seven positions. Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah, if Lynch is open, I go at 2:50, can we make it to 12:50 then? Would that help?
I don't know.
Or even extend it to when we raise that money? Because it was kind of last minute.
Yeah, it was. That's far as that goes.
It was rather a short suspense there, Dean.
Okay, election of officers to the executive board. There's all seven positions are open: chair, vice chair, secretary, treasurer, and three at large. We are taking nominations now. I myself will nominate myself. I've been the chair for 5 years, and I'm happy to do it again.
I'd like to nominate Stuart Sims. He's here on my left. He's been a member of the party for quite a while, and he's someone who has done a lot of good things, whose judgment I trust and welcome to be on the executive committee.
Do you accept the nomination? Okay.
Great.
Mr. Linder?
I'd like to nominate myself.
Mike has done a fine job as the treasurer. I'd like to nominate Dr. Robert Glazer, our secretary.
I'd like to nominate Susan, who's been my campaign manager and has been very active in party of those in terms of outreach to young voters as well as outreach to them.
Okay. You accept? Okay.
I nominate Art.
Okay. And you accept?
Yeah.
Hey, how many is that? Just one more.
I nominate Mark Ravitz.
Ha.
He's
not here. He's not here. Well, there's not many whether he likes it or not. He's welcome to
step in.
What's that? That's seven. Anybody else?
You want to be nominated, Valenzo?
Well, I don't know.
I nominate Lorenzo for the executive committee.
If you accept, we have to take the vote. That, you know, do the wacky dean voting system. That's up to you.
Right on the spokesperson for the party.
Correct.
Correct.
And I would like you to continue doing it.
You'd like to continue doing it.
Absolutely.
Now, in order for me to do that, do I have to be part of the executive board?
No.
No. Okay. Well, it seems to me that that is only the only thing I do anyway.
Okay.
So I don't accept that nomination.
You have to follow instructions and not have any provocative views on the ranch.
Okay. We can nominate Bishop of Slate with a 2/3 vote. All those in favor of the slate of officers to the executive board, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And thank you, Lorenzo, for not making us go through the voting system, which I still have yet to figure out in 5 years into the chair. Any other new business?
Dean.
Oh.
There was new business.
Oh,
yeah,
you want
to raise the
delegates.
You
should have
followed that
before we
went to the bathroom.
Did you have a somewhere?
Oh, I completely forgot about that, brother. Thank you. Thank you for.
Actually.
I think we had, what, two proposals? Yes, please.
Yeah.
Peter, you had a resolution you wish to introduce.
I have a resolution. You already know what the subject is about from the earlier discussion. I will read the resolution now that I'm defended. Whereas the Libertarian Violent Party bylaws do not authorize the floor seats of delegates, whereas in 40 years of LP conventions, no attempt to impose a floor seat on delegates has ever been sustained, whereas the imposition of any floor seat constitutes an unjustified interference in the right of the affiliate party to select their own delegates to a national convention, therefore, the Maryland Libertarian Party hereby rebukes the convention oversight committee's attempt to impose such a fee as a condition of delegates performing their function at the business meeting, urges the LNC to reverse the proposed floor fee and instructs our delegates to oppose and, if necessary, make motions from the floor to invalidate any such fee as it may be used to prevent any delegate from access to the business of the convention.
Do I hear a second?
Second!
Does anybody wish to speak for or against the resolution, Mr. Linder?
Yes, thank you, Bob. The first problem I have is that resolution sounds like we as Maryland convention here trying to tell national committee what to do.
The national committee
ought to make that decision, not as a party. I mean, that to me, it's a separation of, when the delegates get there, they can pass a resolution and say they should do this.
I don't think they can make passes unless they're making this resolution at the wrong place. Unless we have access to the floor, we will not be allowed to make it. That's why now is the time to make it. Okay, anybody else wish to speak for or against Dinamont's resolution? Mr. Reynolds, it's more or less a question: what is the purpose of the floor fee?
I'd rather not say. Oh, come on. Well, I think it goes somewhere other than that. It's fundraising. It's to bring in money into the coffee. Okay, so why didn't we raise the price of the convention by 70 bucks? No, that's the point, is the convention is because they're trying to squeeze the money out of people who might go without buying a convention. In other words, if you're a business person, if you're a delegate, and you are only going to attend the delegate's official business, and you don't care that you're not going to the breakfast, and you don't care that you're not hearing the speeches you've got to pay for, and all that stuff, then you may not buy a ticket at all. And so they're trying to get you to put in money anyway.
In other words, they're talking about me.
How much is it? $94. $94.
Free of charge.
That's right.
But say that's what we're saying. So the delegates, the national convention, voting on LP business, it should be free of charge.
Probably.
I just wanted to point out two things from Chuck Wilson's email that were brought up already. One was the fact that this could be counterproductive, in that if you drive away delegates who can't afford or do not wish to purchase the hotel will have less people registering there, and the cost of holding the convention will go up. And of course, there's also just the disturbing fact of having an empty convention floor for the Libertarian National Convention. And as it was pointed out before as well, there's a full tax and it reflects that on the card.
Okay. Any other comments for or against? All those in favor of Dinamont's resolution say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Resolution passes. Dr. Glaser, we had the program committee a couple of weeks ago. I want to thank Dr. Glaser for reminding me, because I completely forgot about including it in part of the agenda. There were, I believe, two items. Would you like to speak there?
Well, I put a couple of copies on every table of our program as it exists with the two changes that the program committee recommended. There were two. I guess they voted on separately. The program committee recommended both of them. The first one is towards near the bottom. There's to add a new bullet to the land use, transportation, and the environment section. So the bottom bullet, the one to the fourth bullet, I put it in brackets to mean that's what they're proposing we add. And that says, insisting on maintaining local control of zoning decisions.
Okay.
So I guess we could vote on that first.
I'm not quite sure what the change is.
What, if we can discuss it, but we're not allowed to?
I mean, that's a separate. We can vote on each of these things separately.
Right.
Yeah, we can discuss it, of course.
Okay, what was the first one again?
Adding a new bullet to the land use, transportation, and the environment section, which says, insisting on maintaining local control of zoning decisions.
Does anybody want to speak to or for that amendment to the program? Mr. Wilcox?
I'd like to speak for it, because right now our dear governor, Mr. O'Malley, is working very hard to assert the power of localities over land use zoning. Now, we are not in favor of zoning.
That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is further taking away the power of the local communities and counties and states and counties in the state to make decisions on land use and putting everything in the hands of the state government. And what that would do is, well, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. People will have absolutely no voice. There's very little voice now. There's going to be even less voice on how things are handled. So I think we have to speak to them.
Okay.
And I think that's one way to do it. I think the most clear way to do it.
Mr. Jones,
anything that we need to work in getting Maryland National Capital Park in planning, which really screws things up?
We can only go up or down. We have to amend it at the program committee before the convention.
We have to make a suggestion to the program committee, and then.
But this is an up or down.
Oh, it's up down, so I can just suggest something.
Do it. We can do it for next year's program committee. As far as for tonight, all we can do is just up or down. Any other comments on this specific program change?
Mr. Second, what the rest of the
Okay. All those in favor of the change, the amendment to the state party program, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, it passes the second program change.
The first one has to deal with the first bullet under the education section, which, as it presently reads, says allowing for increased parental choice within the government public school system, parentheses, e.g., tax credits, vouchers, school district selection, etc. And it's to strike out the words within the government public school system and replace them with the words in education. So the whole bullet will then read, allowing for increased parental choice in education, parentheses, e.g., tax credits, vouchers, school district selection, etc.
Anybody like to speak on that? Mr. Moore.
I think it's silly for it to be only within the government school system, which is what it sounds like. I think that in terms of actual education reform, it's probably going to be outside of the government school system. And part of that actually involves not even fighting for funding and vouchers. Part of that actually involves fighting for deregulation. Right now, if you're in Baltimore, which has among the worst schools in the entire country. Yeah. If you're in Baltimore and you choose to send your kids to, for example, Huntington Learning Center all day, every day, you would be in violation of the truancy laws because it's not accredited by the school. So saying limiting it to within the government school system, to me, I just don't think it makes any sense at all. I think it's much stronger if we have a broader category that includes both the public and the private institutions.
I definitely concur with that.
I'd like to add something to that also. This section on education has been evolving. We started out with just trying to make it as bland as possible so that it would gain wider acceptance with the idea that, as it says in the preamble, that we're just taking incremental steps. And I believe actually the baseline that we're working from right now is not the most up-to-date one. I believe that at a previous convention we had added within the government public school system, we'd added the word at least to make it even more closer to what we really want to do. Now we feel that in the program committee, we felt that we reached a point where we could take yet another incremental step and be a little bit more radical because there was, society and our culture is evolving to that point where we can be a little bit closer to saying what we really want to do and not quickly put so much.
Okay. Anybody else wish to speak on this potential program change?
Just in support of it helps us also reach out to the relatively large libertarian homeschooling.
Oh, yeah.
So it was that strong, but they are very strong.
They're very strong. And
very organized.
Very good. All those in favor of the program change say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Does anybody else have any new business they would like to bring up?
Yes. Just a quick announcement. We have previously said that VFI was not going to be running for U.S. Senate, and the reason was that up until this date, March 3rd, we haven't made the target of $10,000 in pledges. But some people, notably Mr. Rudwan here, said, give me more time, we can do it. And he's agreed to give us a month and revisit the question. So since you say we have until June anyway, we could hopefully, if we have all of the ducks in a row and he's ready to run, maybe organize another nomination meeting.
Sure. We're going to need it. If we have just more
candidates. Yeah, we'll have more candidates anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we do have time, we're fortunate. Any other new business?
Any other
new business. That was announced about so far. Mr. Linder. Okay, announcement.
Just recently, I've received at the our post office letters from the different counties saying they're doing a logic test on the die vault voting machines. So if anybody really wants to go through them, let me know. I got some of the information, or you can just look up your local county's board of elections. They'll say the date of it. Nothing really truly, but I've seen them before, so the policy. The other thing is, before you go, I get some stuff in. Those of you who have these name badges, once they go plastic back, help save money when you do next year. The other thing is, Robert Green is trying to, if you need a new picture, more up to date picture, or you don't have pictures, and you can come back next year, we'll agree to take your picture and try to use it for next year.
Yeah. So, Robert, if you don't like
your picture, why not? Well, I'm just saying, you don't like your picture, get an like your picture, take another picture.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other announcements?
Just a reminder, if any of you want to get MDLP lessons, but I have the form with me, so I can give it to you today if you want to. That's a $25 fee to the Department of Motor Vehicles. I guess that's the main barrier. Also, on a personal note, I have these beautiful MDLP caps for sale. $20, I'm still underwater on them.
You shouldn't follow that.
So we've been to the National Convention. We will also be holding the House and Towns Festival. Phil Bazell will be running that. We can always use help with that booth. I would also like to say this, too, before we close. I particularly would like to thank Mr. Calpino for coming up and giving his spirited defense, even though he didn't get the nomination. I spoke with Mike 2 weeks ago. I said, there is a very good chance you may not get that nomination. And he drove 3.5 hours up each way from Wicomico County to do that. He didn't get the usual talking points, oh, we got to, you know, fix what we broke and all that, you know, shtick. You know, I admire him for the guts for coming up here and giving a well-spoken, passionate defense of what it is. I hope you stay in the party. I hope you run for the Wicomico County Council 2014. I really do. I think you're a solid candidate. And thanks again for coming up, even though you didn't get the nomination. Anything else before we close?
As a new person here, I just want to say I'm very impressed with the way you run things.
Thank you. I went to a few hellacious central committee meetings back in the day, and I vowed, it's like, I'm not going through that again. They would go 2 hours, they're the most picking new things. And thank you for the compliment.
All right, how much you pay?
No, remember that one time we had, I think, a half hour, 45 minute argument whether to invite Judge Jim Gray to come out here. I mean, people were just arguing for 45 minutes whether we should just invite this guy to come to a convention or not. People were like, oh my God.
No way. So thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Also, again, I appreciate the break and the clean presentation.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming out.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you, everyone. Meeting adjourned.
Second.
We're about 5 minutes to eat.